Well, greetings once again, dear listeners, and thank you for joining us here at the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm Bruce G. McCarthy, your host for the remainder of this hour, and you are listening to Datum Line. In our previous Datum Line broadcast, entitled Economic Myths and the Science of Deceit, Part 29, we continued with our inquiry as to who actually owns the gold that was confiscated from our ancestors in 1934. Whoever it is probably has a lawful claim to the silver that was also siphoned out of the economy during the 1960s. The question of lawful ownership arises in response to frequent claims made by Federal Reserve critics, populists in particular, that the bankers own most of the gold that was coined in the United States prior to the 1934 era. Another perspective on the ownership question has it that Uncle Sam was the proprietor of those gold and silver coins. Most of us at one time or another heard it said that the coins minted by the U.S. Treasury were actually government property. This was usually announced in context with the allegation that someone had recently defaced those coins, either by melting them down for use in jewelry, or perhaps by having a locomotive squash them into large disks on the railroad tracks. An alternative viewpoint, however, and one that doesn't get much attention these days, is that the gold and silver belonged to an overly trusting general public who were encouraged by the bankers to deposit those coins as a matter of routine at the local bank for safekeeping. Then, with as little fanfare as possible, the rug was pulled out from under those unsuspecting depositors in 1934. All of their gold deposits were suddenly and unexpectedly confiscated. They were permitted only to receive an equal dollar sum in bills of credit, or else in silver coins, which were becoming much more cumbersome in a modern era of inflation brought on by ever-expanding bank credit. With the promise of new regulations and deposit insurance provided by FDIC, those who had become suspicious of the bankers were lulled into complacency once again, and the routine of depositing their silver coins at the local bank commenced anew. Thus, in 1965, a trusting public would again fall victim to another incredible heist. This time, their silver coins were quickly swapped for U.S. Treasury look-alike imitations made out of copper and nickel, a bait-and-switch operation performed at the local banks. Thanks to Congress and the Federal Reserve System, the last of our constitutional money was finally gone. They didn't even bother trying to get a constitutional amendment to do it, either in 1934 or 1965. Apparently, we were already conditioned by economic mythology to let go of the Constitution and our lawful money. America entered the brave new world of 100% intangible credit almost 50 years ago. That is how long we've been without a monetary system. For any myth believers out there, credit and money are not synonyms. Now, if those coins were indeed government property, then maybe Congress had a right to confiscate my grandparents' gold in 1934. And my parents' silver in 1965. Maybe those coins were just on loan to the public, like so many Federal Reserve notes now on loan to Uncle Sam in today's game of monetized debt. On the other hand, if the gold and silver coins were lawfully owned by individuals among the general population, then how was their ownership in that gold transferred to Congress? Or did it somehow pass to the Federal Reserve System? Today's message will continue to probe this question as we return to author Henry Dunning McLeod in A History of Banking in All the Leading Nations, Volume 2, Chapter 3, published in 1896. In our last broadcast, Mr. McLeod introduced us to the subject of property as it relates to bank deposits by first comparing a solicitor and the old-time money scrivener to the present-day banker. In so doing, he highlighted the wholesale confusion that envelops the subject of banking, even to present day. So frequently did he mention or allude to the words misconception and delusion in regards to bankers and banking, that it should have aroused public suspicion. If banking is a white-collar crime, however, as I've alleged, then bankers don't want a victimized public to understand how this criminal confidence game is orchestrated, or the political and economic consequences that result from the choices we all have made over the last 100 years. These great misconceptions and pure delusions mentioned by McLeod and experienced by the general public were intentionally inflicted upon society, but the victims are not totally innocent. The judicial system holds us responsible for the natural and probable consequences which result from those contractual ties created between the bankers and ourselves. While it's obvious that bank customers know very little or nothing about banking and bank fraud, it's equally obvious that most people don't want to know. When an ugly truth begins to make some people feel uncomfortable, they will reject that information by whatever means necessary. The latest debt ceiling charade gave Americans an opportunity to question our centrally planned credit system. How the dollar faucet is so quickly turned off and on. Where those dollars come from, what they're made of, if anything, and at what cost to the public, compared to those who create those dollars out of absolutely nothing. If people were not asking questions when the federal spigot was turned off, why should they be asking any questions now that federal dollars are flowing freely again? They're ready to go shopping. Gee, ain't this system grand? All it took was a little cooperation from those stubborn Republicans and a few trillion dollars from God knows where. Everything we want is now at our fingertips, even universal health care. Just keep swiping the card, but don't ask any of those embarrassing questions. But back to McLeod and the year 1896. Prior to the bankers, whoever stood as an agent between a lender of money and a borrower of that money did not acquire any property in the money. That property passed directly from the lender to the borrower without pausing to bless the middleman, who only received a commission for his services. The money was received as a bailment, or depositum, a Latin phrase, these middlemen acting as trustees rather than proprietors of that money. A depositum, in the Latin, and in the civil law contract, is where the property and the money or tangible goods remains in the depositor and does not pass to the middleman. Bankers, however, and the goldsmiths who preceded them, on the other hand, put a new twist on the idea of money middleman. They would not only receive the money from depositors, they would become the owners of that money and would use it as the basis for lending credit in the form of notes, checks, then demand deposit entries in a checking account, and now electronic entries in credit or debit accounts. Another set of customers would be led to believe that they were actually borrowing money instead of credit. Bankers, in fact, would leverage far more credit than there was money back in the old days when there really was some tangible money on deposit. Here in the United States, that would have been prior to 1965, before many of our listeners were even born. According to McLeod, when a customer paid money into their account at the bank during the 1800s, they surrendered all property and the money to the banker. Wow. Today's message, Economic Myths and the Science of Deceit, Part 30. I'm Bruce G. McCarthy, and you are listening to That Online. Welcome back to this segment of Thatam Line. I'm Bruce G. McCarthy. Our message today, Economic Myths and the Science of Deceit, Part 12:30. On the front side of our first break, I had reintroduced to the listener two words, both of which were from the Latin, one the word depositum and the word mutuum. These had been introduced to us by Henry Dunning McLeod in A History of Banking in All the Leading Nations, edited by William Graham Sumner, published in 1896. I like going back in time. There's so much to learn back there. Most people aren't interested in looking back, but that's the direction that you're going to find very essential truths. Anyway, how many 19th and 20th century bank customers do you suppose fully understood the difference between a depositum and a mutuum when they did business with a bank? Now, how many do you think understand this today? Farmers who produce corn and wheat will understand how this mutuum works, I'm pretty sure. When they put their product in a local grain elevator, one grain of corn or grain of wheat looks like all the rest. Whoever produces a nutritionally superior organic variety will get no more for his grain than what the mass producers get for theirs at the grain elevator. This wheat or corn is not a depositum. It's a mutuum. Farmers have a claim to an equal amount of grain at the elevator, but not the exact grain they produced and delivered. So why produce organic, open-pollinated heirloom corn for a market that doesn't regard this variety as being any better than transgenic GMO corn? Okay. Well, you wouldn't, would you? Well, let's get back to banking and see how that relates. Bankers enlisted the support of Congress to put credit on the same footing as lawful money, gold and silver, with a legal tender act that says $1 of credit is just as good as a $1 gold or silver coin. Welcome to the money elevator. A deposit receipt from your bank will not state whether you handed over a $1 coin of 90% pure gold, $1 of 90% pure silver, a $1 coin of 40% pure silver. They were manufactured, you remember, back in the late 60s. A $1 coin of copper and nickel, like the big Eisenhower and the small Susan B. A $1 Federal Reserve note, whether it has a promise on it or no promise, as they began in 1963, shortly after Kennedy was assassinated. Or a $1 check. On a bank statement, they all look exactly alike. And all you're entitled to receive is an equal dollar amount in whatever form the banker chooses to let you have. Color your gold and silver gone. It was a mutuum, not a depositum. The banker bought the gold and silver, he said, from his customer with a credit he created in his books. This credit was a right of action to demand an equivalent amount of money from the banker, not the same money or even the same kind of money. And as I mentioned in the previous broadcast, there were two things left unsaid by McLeod in regards to this phenomenon. And he was an avid fan of banking and bank credit. First, the definition for the word money was omitted. And second, that the IOUs created by the banker exceeded the amount of money on deposit. But by how much did it exceed the amount of money? An investigation of a London bank, you may remember we've been here before, by the British Parliament, revealed that 50 times more IOUs, at least 50 times more, than specie on deposit, specie being gold and silver. And that was during the bank panic of 1857. This, plus the fact that people unwittingly referred to credit instruments as money, opened the door wide to continual plunder of the general populace by the banking cartel, along with future bank panics and economic disasters that would surely follow. It's like the world of agribiz, where grain goes into the elevator with no incentive for the farmer to produce higher quality grain. Legal tender acts and the concept of a mutuum produce similar effects in the world of money and credit. Thus, horrific losses were visited upon the non-bank public who deposited high quality money in the form of gold, or promises to pay gold prior to 1934, but could only withdraw an equal number of dollars in silver coin or promises to pay silver thereafter. On the second go-around, they deposited good quality money in the form of silver, or promised to pay silver. But in 1965, they were denied the right to receive their silver. We could only retrieve an equal dollar amount of credit that now promised to pay us absolutely nothing. While the depositor of gold and silver called his coins a deposit, they were not defined or acknowledged as a depositum by the banker, who, unbeknownst to his customer, took advantage of a newly created definition that he applied to an ancient Latin word. The word depositum, said Henry MacLeod, in classical Latin meant a material thing, but in modern times has come to mean only an abstract right, end quote. Now, how a word from a dead language, the meaning of which should have been frozen in time, could take on a new meaning, even the opposite meaning, he didn't explain. But this is another example of language manipulation to benefit the manipulator. The deceitful nomenclature of banking was invented by bankers, not by their customers. When definitions changed, it was because the bankers profited from the change. We are expected to play a losing game by their slippery definitions, whether we understand those definitions or not. And the stakes in this game are exceedingly high. Turning to page 205 in A History of Banking, 1896, quote, a banker's profits, according to MacLeod, depend upon the quantity of credit he can maintain in circulation in excess of the cash he holds in reserve. That was back in 1896 when there was cash. Now there isn't any. Remember the Federal Reserve said, page 7, I bet you thought, banks don't keep cash in checking accounts. Don't transfer cash or currency when acting on a check's instructions. It's only bookkeeping entries that change, okay? Anyway, MacLeod says, a bank is therefore not an office for borrowing and lending money, but it is a manufactory of credit. Credit, you remember, comes from the Latin word credere, which means simply to believe. Credit is intangible. You can't see, smell, hear, taste, or touch it. It's not a gas, liquid, or a solid. This explodes another popular delusion, you see, about bankers who lend credit. They do not lend money, as the general population still believes. To issue credit in excess of the money promised is also a crime for which a non-banker, like you or me, would be fined or imprisoned. MacLeod manages to overlook this fact, however, as if it were the least among minor details. He says, it is often the custom of persons to say that they have so much money at their bankers, but such an expression is wholly erroneous and misleading. They have no money at their bankers. They have nothing but an abstract right of action. Okay? Anyway, when this was written in 1896, you could demand and were likely to receive money for a promise to pay monetary gold or silver. Assuming, of course, that you had not been preceded by too many other customers demanding their money. Every once in a while, that would happen, you know, and the confidence game would be exposed. Those events were called bank panics back in the old days. Now they're called economic meltdowns. On page 207, MacLeod again dispels a popular myth about banking. He says, quote, it is almost universally supposed by lay writers that when a customer pays in money to his account with his banker, it is a deposit, and that the deposits of a bank are the cash held in reserve. This, however, is a pure delusion. Ah, there's our music. Here's our next break. I'm Bruce G. McCarthy. This is Economic Myths and the Science of Deceit, Part 30, and you are listening to Davimore. Back to this segment of Bottom Line, I'm Bruce G. McCarthy. We're discussing the subject of property in deposits made to a bank, and we go back into the 1800s to learn what we could have learned had we read such a book. But most of us wouldn't have been interested then. Most people aren't interested today. It's amazing what you can learn from the past. He said, quote, this is Henry Dunning McLeod now. He has lots of letters behind his name. Maybe one of these days I'll read you all of his credentials. When a customer, he says, in the ordinary way, pays in money to his account with a banker, he loses all property in it. The banker acquires the absolute property in it to use for his own advantage. Such money, therefore, is not a depositum. It is a mutuum or creditum. If the money so paid in were a depositum, it would mean that the banker acquired no property in it, that the property in it remained with the customer, who placed it in his banker's hands for pure safekeeping, and that he could demand back that specific sum of money at any time he pleased. But every person who thinks knows that such ideas are erroneous, end quote. On page 208, he says, quote, deposits are nothing but banknotes in disguise. But what are deposits? Well, bankers redefine them as credit or a right of action, which he creates out of absolutely nothing, which means deposits are created out of nothing, unlike the deposits that a farmer has out behind the barn, which are not created out of nothing. You know, disguise is a great choice of words. He said the deposits are nothing but banknotes in disguise. And I think that's a great choice of words by McLeod, because almost everything about banking is a disguise. The gold coins that were deposited by my grandparents were quickly disguised as a mere book entry called dollars. A sum of cheap bank credit was disguised as a precious metal, also called dollars. My grandparents' gold was stolen under the disguise of a purchase, where $20.67 of absolutely nothing was traded for every troy ounce of pure gold. And that was called the official price of gold. What nonsense. Slavery is disguised as a bank loan, where bankers pretend to monetize a sum of money the borrower promises to repay while receiving absolutely nothing from the banker, who was erroneously presumed to be the source of a non-existent loan. The borrower now consenting that he will owe an additional fee called interest, which, along with the fictitious principal, must be serviced by his labor, expended over many months or even years. A slave labor economy fueled by 100% bank credit is disguised as a free market, where, if you did what the godmen do, you would go to prison. Free enterprise and monopolies are mutually exclusive. To call this a free market, where a chosen few are licensed to steal from everyone else while sharing the proceeds with Congress, is a contradiction of terms. Nonsense is disguised as economic expertise, and the layman is somehow expected to decipher the absurdities emanating from all sides of a subject by an army of experts who cannot define the most basic economic expressions they use day in and day out. Is it any wonder that McLeod was able to highlight several popular delusions about banking back in 1896. But let's turn to page 209, where he says, quote, lay writers who know nothing of the mechanism of banking have asserted that the London banks are, like the banks of Venice, Amsterdam, etc., pure banks of deposit, that they do not create credit, and that their whole business is to lend out the money they borrow from their customers. All such ideas are, however, pure delusions. Bankers now, as ever, make all their advances by creating credits or deposits in their books. But instead of giving their customers two methods of circulating these credits, by means of notes or of checks, they are now restricted to one method, checks. End quote. Well, that was then. Bank customers can now use electrons. And if the banker says those electrons add up to a positive balance in your electronic account, then you can swipe the card and get some groceries. If he says they don't, then you might go hungry. Jumping ahead to page 335, we find a subtitle, quote, on the ratio of money to credit. And this as it pertained to England in the mid-1800s. This addresses the myth that London banks were pure banks of deposit and did not create credit in excess of the money on deposit. figures provided to the British House of Commons by Mr. Slater of Morrison, Dillon and Company revealed, I'm now on page 336, that, quote, specie, that's gold and silver, did not enter into their transactions for little more than 2%. Excuse me. A similar investigation, says McLeod, instituted by some bankers, resulted in showing that specie only entered into their operations to the amount of 4 per 1,000, or 0.0025%. That's in the 1800s. He says, it is usually considered that the quantity of coin, gold and silver, he says, in circulation in this country, that was Great Britain in 1896, may be estimated at not far from 120 million pounds sterling. And if we take as a moderate estimate that the quantity of credit, this is a moderate estimate now, that the quantity of credit is 50 times the quantity of money, as the above figures indicate, and I didn't bore you with the figures, which you would probably forget anyway, it would appear that the quantity of credits or debts of all kinds in the country is about 6 billion pounds sterling. Ah, 120 million pounds sterling in the bank, and they create 6 billion pounds sterling in promises to pay it. Okay? Anyway, he says, this credit produces exactly the same effects and affects prices exactly as so much gold. He goes on to say that it is through the excessive creation of this species of property, which he calls credit, that all commercial crises are brought about. McLeod then goes on to say that these commercial crises develop into monetary panics. Now, panics are evidently quite easy and inexpensive to produce, if you know how to produce them. Turning to page 337, he says, money is a very expensive machine to purchase and keep up. Mm-hmm. But banking credits cost nothing to create, and they may endure forever, end quote. Now, McLeod presses his luck a little too far on that one. Forever is a period of time known only to God. Bank credit is the product of the God-men, or God-wannabes. And the value of credit evaporates rather quickly, as any shopper who pays attention to prices will now attest. Credit will never endure forever, Mr. McLeod. So banks in England were creating credit to the tune of at least 50 times more IOUs than there was money to redeem them. And since the public had been taught to believe that credit was money, and that credit was what paid for goods and services, when in fact it didn't, then popular delusion would hold that credit could buy the money. It could buy the gold and silver, instead of the other way around. Gold or silver, however, purchased the note, an economic phenomenon called redemption, meaning to obtain by repurchase. Nevertheless, here's McLeod, a champion of bank credit, who reveled in overturning one popular misconception after another, the same writer we've quoted in previous broadcasts, to wit, for what is the commodity which a banker deals in and makes a profit by? He opens his place of business and has an array of clerks with their desks, ledgers, etc. Keep our ancestors in 1934 in mind as I read the next three sentences. He then gives notice that he is ready to buy gold from anyone who has it to sell. Yeah, whether they were willing to sell it or not. And what is the commodity with which he buys the gold? What does he give in exchange for it? His own credit, end quote. Okay, so if the public could be convinced that their gold was not purchasing credit, but that credit was actually buying the gold, and bankers could create credit out of nothing at no cost to themselves, then bankers could acquire the public's gold for nothing. The only thing necessary was to massage our vocabulary based on a faulty premise that if credit acts like money, it must be money. After that, it was easy to call the theft of America's gold a purchase for which our ancestors were so-called paid $20.67 of absolutely nothing for every troy ounce of pure gold they had no express intention to sell. A forced sale, a nationwide forced sale at that, is not compatible with a free market. Here's our music. Here's another break. Economic Myths and the Science of Deceit, Part 30. I'm Bruce G. McCarthy, and you are listening to Datum Line. This last segment of this installment of Datum Line. You know, margarine looks and acts like butter, but that's the best we can say for it. Margarine is not butter. Our regular listeners realize that a check written on no funds also acts like money. But bankers are waiting to catch any competitor who tries to break into their monopoly. Other than that, a check that you would write on no funds is no different than the white-collar crime that's committed by those who got a license from Congress to do it legally, but not lawfully. Remember, legal and lawful are not synonyms. Anyway, so back to the question of property or ownership in the gold that was deposited at the bank just before it was stolen in 1934. If my grandfather earned it through honest labor, it was his gold. If he clipped the coin so as to remove some of its gold content before passing it on to someone else in the purchase of goods and services, he would have been guilty of debasing the coin, not defacing it. To debase the coin was to reduce the bargained for consideration that the next party had a lawful right to receive for his labor. If that were done by an official at one of the Treasury facilities, he would have been charged with a felony and could have been put to death. So serious was this offense in the eyes of our forefathers, pursuant to the Coinage Act of April 2, 1792, at Section 19. Issuing promises to pay gold that the bankers knew did not exist, so as to acquire someone else's gold that did exist, was also a crime. Did or could lawful title to Grandpa's gold pass to the bankers by unlawful means? Is a deceived and deluded populace without lawful recourse to recover property that was stolen from their ancestors by conspiratorial acts of fraud that were legalized by acts of Congress? You know, it was United States Supreme Court Justice Louis D. Brandeis who rendered the legal decision that included these words, quote, "Government must obey the law scrupulously, for when it fails to do so, it breeds contempt for law and order," end quote. When state legislators in the 1800s authorized state chartered banks to issue credit instruments over and above the gold and silver coin on reserve for redemption, they opened the door to legalized theft of the public's money by the bankers. When Congress authorized the Federal Reserve to open its doors with a 40% gold reserve, when we were allegedly on a gold coin standard, they paved the way for legalized theft of the public's gold in 1934. In 1945, you remember, they lowered the reserve requirement to 25% while we were on a gold bullion standard, allegedly. And in 1968, they lowered the gold reserve to 0%, America having apparently entered the gold exchange standard. Now, it might be argued that the public demanded this kind of legislation, as when populists urged Congress to issue greenbacks on behalf of the debt-ridden farmers back in the late 1800s to help them pay off the debts easier, you understand. But sin does not become lawful simply because a voting majority of licensed attorneys, vested with the power of public office, wrote a statute to make it so. Being clothed with the public trust, it was their duty to prevent the organized plunder of the public's wealth, with the resulting moral decline of a nation that legalized criminal behavior on behalf of a chosen few. Those farm debts of the 1800s were contracted for money that the bankers never loaned. But rather than confront the first sin, public officials and the general public chose a cheap fix to the problem by adding sin to sin. We've learned nothing from biblical history, secular history, or from the law written on our hearts. Rather than examine and correct the cause of our ever-increasing economic calamities, Congress pretends to impose a debt ceiling, which they expect to overturn whenever the political pressure rises to uncomfortable levels or their political fortunes are enhanced by robbing a deceived populace who need the truth far more than they ever needed universal health care. While we're steeped in the musings of Henry Dunning McLeod, let's add a few of his observations about banking in Scotland for the benefit of our listeners over in the UK. On page 213, he says, the Bank of Scotland was founded in 1695 with unlimited power of issue. They could issue all the notes they wanted, and they didn't have to have any gold or silver, both in amount and denomination. At first, it only issued notes of 100, 50, 10, and 5 pounds sterling. Though several times urged to do so, they did not issue 1-pound notes at first, but in 1704, they began to do so, page 216. After explaining to his readers, how the impoverished farmer in Scotland would benefit from loans of nothing created out of a sincere and heartfelt concern by the civic-minded banker, the author says that, quote, the banks everywhere granted cash credits to the farmers, the advances being made exclusively in their own one-pound notes. A farm loan? Exclusively in one-pound notes? Doesn't that seem odd? McLeod said, with these advances in one-pound notes, the farmers employed the laborers in reclaiming the land, bought seed, and sowed the crops. And in a few years, bleak and barren moors were everywhere changed into fields of waving corn. I'm getting misty. And they produced a continuous series of profits. They sure did. And I can think of somebody who profited more than anybody else. Anyway, sounds noble and wonderful, almost utopian. But again, doesn't it seem just a bit odd that farm loans were made exclusively in the lowest denomination banknotes available? Would you expect a car loan to be made in $1 bills? But they must have been honest notes, right? It's the large denomination notes that people worry about, and some merchants now refuse to accept. Listen carefully to McLeod. Quote, from the strong constitution of the banks and the universal confidence they had acquired, their notes were universally received as cash, and though they were demandable in cash at the head office, no one ever dreamt of demanding payment for them. Now, our regular listeners with a good memory may recall a reference to this same Scottish phenomenon submitted by Senator Thomas Benton of Missouri in Volume 1 of his autobiographical work, 30 Years' View, published in 1854. His observations were actually made in 1832 when the Second Bank of the United States petitioned Congress for a 20-year charter renewal. Senator Benton was tightly aligned with President Andrew Jackson opposing the renewal and accused the bank of issuing an illegal and vicious currency. He had learned that its notes were being issued at the most remote and inaccessible branch banks where their redemption was voluntary, with compulsory redemption available only at Philadelphia. Distance and difficulty would result in those notes wearing out in the hands of the people, thus providing higher bank profits since those notes would never be presented for redemption. And they were in low denominations. He says, quote, the origin of this kind of currency was thus traced by me. It was invented by a Scotch banker in Aberdeen who issued notes payable in London, always of small denominations that nobody should take them up to London for redemption. The Bank of Ireland, seeing what a pretty way it was to issue notes which they could not practically be compelled to pay, adopted the same trick. The English country bankers followed the same example. End quote. 30 Years' View, Volume 1, page 220, published in 1854. Yet here was McLeod praising the virtues of Scotland's banking system. He says no one even dreamt of demanding payment for those notes. Well, those notes were only made payable, he said, at the head office, which was so far away and the notes were of so low a denomination that the public didn't bother. And that became a windfall profit to the banking system. He goes on, quote, all the marvelous results which have raised Scotland from the lowest depths of barbarism. Are you Scott listening out there? Okay. Up to her present proud position in the space of 200 years are the children of pure credit. Scotland, he says, was the most utterly barbarous and lawless country in Europe. Ouch. The two greatest causes of her rapid rise in civilization and wealth have been her systems of national education and banking. He says her system of banking has been of infinitely greater service to her than mines of gold and silver, said McLeod. Mines of the precious metal would probably only have demoralized her people and made them more savage than they were before. Ooh. But her banking system has tended immensely to call forth every manly virtue. It has taught them industry, steadiness, and moral rectitude. Wow! Bankers taught my Scottish kinsmen moral rectitude. Wow! Hey, there's our music. This is the end of this one. I hope you found it of interest. I'm Bruce D. McCarthy, and you were, again, listening to Datum Line. So.
Do you begin to smell some funky little things going on? Let me share this story with you. It's not so much a story, it's something I wrote years ago. Read your history, people. Stock markets collapse on Friday. Bank seizures, closures, holidays take place after business hours on Friday. Do currencies or governments also collapse on Friday? Tomorrow's Friday. Will the end come on this Friday, or will the inevitable collapse hold off for a while? The next round of the worst financial crisis in 100 years is coming, people, and the government is out to make you and I pay for it. And will your savings survive a global banking wipeout? What happens when the U.S. sees hyperinflation? What if taxes soar not only for the rich? Can you survive if the stock market tanks? Look, between a stock market wipeout, waves of bank failures, soaring government spending that will lead to hyperinflation, and the destruction of the dollar's value, isn't it time that you prepare for the uncertainty which lies ahead? Protect your money now, or forever kiss it goodbye. My friends, I offer you over 6 decades experience of hard asset ownership and knowledge, and I'm prepared to handle the smallest detail in the balanced protection of your portfolio. For as the future of uncertainty continues to blanket this nation of ours, I believe that I can offer you the privacy, safety, security, and possibly some profitability which you deserve. And so I invite you to visit SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com for further information regarding protecting your wealth. Or call me, Jeffrey Bennett, at 602-799-8214. Or by email at KettleMoraineLTD@Cox.net for private consultation. Once again, our phone number, 602-799-8214. It's almost Friday.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste by going to rbnhemppaste.com. That's rbnhemppaste.com.
I'm am so excited to have you as part of the Wild Pastures family, and we look forward to bringing you the pasture-raised meats that you and your family will love. Now, we started Wild Pastures because so many of my clients would tell me they just couldn't find high-quality pasture-raised meats, and even when they did, it was so expensive that they couldn't afford to eat it regularly. Now, I'm not talking about the bottom-of-the-barrel healthy meats that have claims like natural or free-range or even cage-free, terms that were actually created by the industrial food industry to make us feel all warm and fuzzy about buying their low-quality products. I'm talking about truly nourishing pasture-raised meats, the kind that you'll never really find in a grocery store. Our farmers are doing things beyond organic. Our beef is 100% grass-fed and grass-finished and raised on pastures free from chemicals and other pesticides. Our chickens are 100% pasture-raised, where they get their natural diet of grass and forage and insects. We will never settle for free-range, which is actually one of the most deceptive terms in the chicken industry. In fact, less than 0.1% of the chicken consumed in the United States is truly pasture-raised in the way that ours is. And our pork is 100% pasture-raised as well. So if you care about where your food comes from, then you have definitely made it to the right place. As a Wild Pastures member, you'll be supporting the most highly principled farmers in America and getting the most nutrient-dense, nourishing, and sustainable meats in the world. I'm confident you'll love being part of our mission at Wild Pastures, and you will really love the delicious, nourishing meats that we're going to deliver straight to your door.
Visit republicbroadcasting.org and click the Wild Pastures banner ad. Secure a shipment today. Beef, poultry, and pork. Raised the way nature intended.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pouty Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus does not grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit drinksupertea.com. The first word is drink, spelled D-R-I-N-K, then the word super, then the word tea. The complete website is drinksupertea.com. Or call us at 818-965-9113, Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-965-9113. DrinkSuperTea.com.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Black Owl Coffee, and I started Black Owl because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee that's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Hey there, are you going to wait till the cows come home to get your new Ease-Off drop-in lift?
What in the world is an Ease-Off drop-in lift?
Our Ease-Off is a new tool to increase production for your meat processing company that will get that whole hog or half a beef on or off your rail with our remote control.
That sounds great, but can I afford it?
Sure, and the Ease-Off installs fast. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue, speed up your line, and increase profits.
Okay, I'm convinced. Where can I get my Ease-Off?
Go to easeoff.com. That's EAZEOFF.com. And hurry, because we're offering free shipping for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff LLC, 417-932-6419.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Do you or someone you know suffer from chest pain, blood pressure, cholesterol, or irregular heartbeat? Are you looking for a more natural solution to overcome these health challenges? You hear the ads all the time. If this stuff's so good, why doesn't my doctor prescribe it? That's easy. Doctors are not trained in natural medicine. Extendivite Heart Tonic does want you to be as healthy as you can be, and it really works. Take Extendivite for 6 months and your doctor will say, I don't know what you're doing, but don't stop. It's working for you. Get the dependability of Extendivite. Just see how you feel in 6 months. A 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid is only $69.95 plus shipping and handling. Call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Hello, hello, hello from beautiful Colorado. My name is Samuel Jung Kay, and I am currently the lead Shilajit hunter and master herbalist for Colorado Shilajit Company. In this video series, I will be discussing what we believe is the greatest of all adaptogenic superfoods and the single greatest natural healing remedy gifted to us by Mother Earth. I think you too will become as excited by this incredible substance called Shilajit as we were and are after our discovery of this amazing gift right here in beautiful, colorful Colorado. You may already know Shilajit by other names: Shilajit, Momio, Momi, Mami, Mineral Pitch, Asphaltum, and others. Shilajit literally translates to destroyer of weakness and conqueror of mountains. Shilajit has been in use for thousands of years and is considered as the highest valued cure-all of any earthly substance.
Look for the gold mountain and medical symbol logo in banners on republicbroadcasting.org to watch the full video and see more information. Use code GORBN when ordering. That's G-O-R-B-N.
The secret to aging like fine wine is in the vines. Syrah grape seeds and skins contain high levels of flavonoids and resveratrol. Fermentation breaks these organic compounds down into smaller molecules, penetrating these therapeutic ingredients deeper into the skin, delivering faster and more effective results. Our handmade fermented skincare products are formulated with all natural ingredients and do not contain any phthalates or parabens. Similar products can cost as much as $180. At Natural Earth Medicine, we source our ingredients from local Arizona vineyards and cold process our oils to ensure that our customers receive the highest quality product in its purest form. Learn more at our website and try our fermented skincare products today. Visit naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
Gilad Atzman says the essence of Jewish power is the ability to prevent the discussion of Jewish power.
Jewish power requires anybody in politics to understand it and know about it, but never talk about it.
My Awakening really sums up with the very best evidence, the facts and the truth about race, and the fact that race drives history, and the truth about the Jewish question.
The younger you get, the greater the percentage of people who identify as alphabet soup, you know, LGBTQ, RS.
This woman, she's like, oh yeah, I identify as a koala 2 years ago. And I'm like, what?
A koala?
What? Maybe if it was Quickie Koala, that might be cool, but otherwise, you know. How about an N-word pass? Have you ever received an N-word pass from any of your black friends?
Biden invited a drag queen to come for the signing of the Respect for Marriage Act. It's the Respect for Anal Sex Act. So, you know, I mean, let's just call it like it is.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show, Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central.
Consider this. Dead people see only what they want to see. And frankly, most of us are still dead. Let me give you the lessons of gold and five easy lessons. Number one, don't buy it because you need to make money. You buy gold because you need to protect the money you already have. Don't ever look at the price as a barrier. Look at it as an incentive. Number three, don't buy its paper pretenders. We talked about that a lot. Buy gold. Buy the real thing in the form of coins and bullion. Fourth, don't fall prey to glitzy television or Facebook ads. Do your due diligence instead. And that's what I try to provide you with and have for 26 and a half years on the air and 30 years in this profession. Fifth, don't allow naysayers to divert your interest. Allow yourself the right to protect your interests as you see fit. Jeff Bennett here. And one of the ways you can do that is to contact Kettle Moraine Limited. Contact me by calling or texting me at 602-799-8214. 602-799-8214. You can also email me at kettlemoraineltd@cox.net. Let me help you protect your wealth and your family today. Once again, call or text us at 602-799-8214 or visit our website, sierramadreprecious metals.com. Be glad to help you out. Be glad to answer your questions. That's what we're here for. No pressure, just good, hard, common sense. The decision then becomes up to you.
I'm so excited to have you as part of the Wild Pastures family, and we look forward to bringing you the pasture-raised meats that you and your family will love. Now, we started Wild Pastures because so many of my clients would tell me they just couldn't find high-quality pasture-raised meats, and even when they did, it was so expensive that they couldn't afford to eat it regularly. Now, I'm not talking about the bottom-of-the-barrel healthy meats that have claims like natural or free-range or even cage-free, terms that were actually created by the industrial food industry to make us feel all warm and fuzzy about buying their low quality products. I'm talking about truly nourishing pasture-raised meats, the kind that you'll never really find in a grocery store. Our farmers are doing things beyond organic. Our beef is 100% grass-fed and grass-finished and raised on pastures free from chemicals and other pesticides. Our chickens are 100% pasture-raised, where they get their natural diet of grass and forage and insects. We will never settle for free range, which is actually one of the most deceptive terms in the chicken industry. In fact, less than 0.1% of the chicken consumed in the United States is truly pasture-raised in the way that ours is. And our pork is 100% pasture-raised as well. So if you care about where your food comes from, then you have definitely made it to the right place. As a Wild Pastures member, you'll be supporting the most highly principled farmers in America and getting the most nutrient-dense, nourishing, and sustainable meats in the world. But I'm confident you'll love being part of our mission at Wild Pastures, and you will really love the delicious, nourishing meats that we're going to deliver straight to your door.
Visit republicbroadcasting.org and click the Wild Pastures banner ad. Secure a shipment today. Beef, poultry, and pork raised the way nature intended.